Welcome to another episode of the Gonzo Chronicles. This is your host, Cyrus Alderwood. And tonight, this is May 19th. I'm actually glad to be joined by Lyle Blackburn. If you haven't heard of Lyle Blackburn, you've probably seen him on so many different TV shows. Lyle, you're a regular on Coast to Coast with George Norrie. You're a regular on Animal Planet, Destination America, Travel Channel, Discovery Channel, the Shudder Network. That's new out. How you doing, Lyle? Thanks for coming on to the show.
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Now you are so well known for being one of the folks on the shows that it's a cryptid hunter, and you have countless books out. Before we get into any of that, though, which is what you're known for, something grabbed my eye off your website that you now make and sell hot sauce. So this is right up my alley. Tell me a little bit about what you're doing there with the hot sauce.
Right. Yeah, this is something new. I just had a kind of a wild idea that I wanted to do a hot sauce because it would be fun. Like I do a lot of cooking, and you know, I'm from Texas. You know, we like some spice. You know, I mean, I'm not crazy on the really spicy stuff, but I like flavor and spice. And there was a couple of things that kind of prompted me to look into doing a hot sauce, and I dreamed up the idea of calling it Monster Sauce, and it would have this, you know, cool like Bigfoot looking thing on it, and it kind of has somebody had made a little icon of me, like a Blackburn with a hat and stuff. So I thought, okay, it's going to be Blackburn's original Monster Sauce. And I ended up finding a bottler here that I could work with outside of Fort Worth, and kind of teamed up to do the Monster Sauce. So at first it just was going to be something that I had, like when I did an event or a book signing, I'd have them on my table. I mean, you know, these are glass bottles and stuff. And when I put some stuff out there and I did a little ad, people were like, oh man, I'd love to order some. So I did put it on my online store for sale, but immediately sold everything I had. I didn't predict, but it's a good thing, you know, that it's in demand. But it, you know, suddenly I'm like, okay, I'm trying to ship out food products and glass bottles, and you know, it quickly got over my head.
Oh, that's pretty awesome. I saw that. And I thought, hey, it's grilling season, so what? Got to bring that up because I'm a sucker for good hot sauce. I get laughed at sometimes because I'll keep Tabasco in my pocket when I go places, just because, you know, just for the hot sauce. But yeah, that's awesome to be able to do that, and being from down there in Texas, it's pretty cool just to, you know, with all that you do, to see the logo on there. So yeah, if people want that, they can actually go to your website, which is lyleblackburn.com, and check out that hot sauce and order it. Hopefully you'll get some in soon to fulfill the orders.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I didn't know what to expect, so I'm correcting that, and I should have it rolling in a more timely fashion here soon. And of course, you know, have it at places that, you know, I've got some retail locations, the Expedition Sasquatch Bigfoot Museum in Georgia, and the North American Bigfoot Center in Oregon, the Monster Mart in Falk, Arkansas, and hopefully get into the Mothman Museum. So I'm slowly working on putting it in places where, you know, fans of this kind of stuff could actually buy it, you know, retail.
Okay, yes, I know there's so many places when you get close to the coast, like near Myrtle Beach. There's a little place on the way out of there. You can find hundreds of kinds of hot sauce. You know, kind of a little tourist trap that I fall into every single time and buy all the kind of the local wares. But, and this is kind of, I'm sure this is a question you've been asked, you know, a million times on podcasts like this, but was there something early on, that a sighting or an experience that you had that put you on the path to all the research on the cryptids, the paranormal, or, you know, how did you kind of fall into this lifestyle?
Well, it wasn't from a sighting or anything. It was something I was immediately enthralled with as a kid. I've always loved monster movies and movie monsters and things as far back as I can remember. And then when I was in elementary school, I got a book that had stories of Bigfoot Yeti and the Loch Ness Monster. And when I learned about those, I was like, whoa, this is cool. This is like, you know, these are like something you could really see in real life, perhaps. And so that was kind of the mix of everything. And I grew up hunting with my father, so I was exposed to a lot of wooded areas and small towns and stuff, which kind of played into, you know, sightings of these creatures. And when I was young, I saw a movie called The Legend of Boggy Creek in a drive-in theater, and that movie dramatized sightings of a Sasquatch-like creature in southern Arkansas, which was much closer to where I lived in Texas, about 3 hours away. So now I'm like, whoa, you know, there's a scary Bigfoot, like, roaming in, you know, in our region. And ever since then, I just loved the subject, and I became a musician and did a lot of touring and playing over the years. But I always kept up and read books and kind of studied, and then eventually wanted to write a book. And so I thought, what's my favorite subject? What would I write about? And I ended up writing The Beast of Boggy Creek, which is about the history of the legend of Boggy Creek and the sighting of that creature. And that sort of just all of a sudden, you know, was contacted by a television show. And then, you know, one thing led to another. So I thought, ah, this is cool. So I just stuck with it.
When I was looking at your website, I was noticing, you know, I guess pre-pandemic, and then, I mean, things have changed since COVID hit, and now they're kind of getting back to normal. But this is not just, I know so many people that are in different fields of study, some cryptid, some UFO, different areas, that for you, it's a lifestyle. It is all encompassing in everything you do, from your travel to your to your hot sauce business, to your books, to your music. How difficult is it to have all that come as a lifestyle and then be able to use that lifestyle as a passion, just to, as a career? Whereas a lot of people have to have a career and then on the side, they do what you do. How did you manage to get that to work, or did it kind of fall together?
Well, a little bit of fall together, but a little bit of just having done this. I mean, the lifestyle itself, it just literally, I just be me. And, you know, that's always within the music and everything I've done. There's always been some element of horror or darkness or something, kind of like, you know, when I started writing cryptid books, they're, you know, they tend to focus on the spooky cases and creatures like Lizard Man and Falk Monster. And but having the experience with music, I was already familiar with, you know, traveling and touring and merchandising and stuff that I had gathered over the years. And when I started writing the book, I kind of just applied the same stuff. So, you know, I started doing events, and, you know, I didn't just have the book. I added a t-shirt, you know, and that kind of helped fund, you know, books, you know, or, you know, there's only so many people that are going to be into this genre. So you got to have the other support. So by having the music and having royalties from that, and then kind of kickstarted me into that. And the more books I've written, obviously, the better it's been. So I've managed to make a living at this. You know, I mean, it's not, and you have to work hard. You know, you're always having to work, and you're trying to do the research, which takes up a ton of time, but you also have to make some money to, you know, pay for food and living and put my daughter, you know, to go to school and what have you. So, but I've just been fortunate, and luckily the response to my books, and I've been involved in narrating quite a few films. So all that together has made me just basically a real life monster hunter, so to speak.
Yeah. I kind of want to get into the films. A lot of people may know you from a show called Monsters and Mysteries in America. And it's one of those shows, when it comes on TV, I have to stop and watch in the middle of the day. Yeah, you know, it doesn't matter. It's such a cool show. You have a history with that show. Was it only some episodes, or how many episodes were you producer and host?
Well, I was on some episodes. They did the Falk Monster, Boggy Creek case, and the Lizard Man. And that's where I first came involved. And then they did a special edition called the Blackburn Files, where they did just one episode that kind of combined some stories. And I was the host on camera for that. And then I became a story producer in season three. So I was on camera in some of those, but on every episode, I was advising behind the scenes with that. So that, and I will say that show was very, you know, was had a lot of integrity. The witnesses you see were real people. They had real encounters. You know, it wasn't overly sensationalized. You know, it was made to be interesting for TV, but it was a great show, and that's one reason I like to work with them, because, you know, there's no fake stuff or anything. So,
Is there anything new in the works coming out from them this year?
No, that show did three seasons, and, you know, it's probably been gone since about 2015. I wish they would have, and I, you know, I discussed season four ideas with them, but ultimately it comes down to the network, and, you know, that was a hard show to keep up, because it required a first-person witness that had a terrifying encounter with a cryptid, and you're only going to get so many of those people that are either still alive or that are willing to talk about it on television. So we just almost ran up against a roadblock to continue that format. And, you know, ultimately, these are the calls of the network, and they just, for whatever reason, ended it. So
it's amazing how wildly popular those shows are, even to this day. And I think people are kind of starving for some new stuff. I noticed on YouTube you had a pilot show called American Monster Tour, but it was only on YouTube. I think you talked about an Oklahoma demon flyer. It's a cryptid that was spotted in and around Oklahoma City. What happened with American Monster Tour, and is there going to be more of that we can look forward to?
That resulted, you know, after having quite a few television experiences and having to deal with the networks making the calls, my colleague Ken Gerhardt, who is also a cryptid hunter who lives in Texas, we would always, you know, we travel around, do stuff together sometimes, and we're like, man, if we just had a camera following us, that would be a pretty good show, you know. Forget all the, you know, the fancy plot lines and whatever. We can make a show. So we had the idea of just producing a couple of those just to see as an example of what it would look like. And just, I don't know, we found a camera guy who was willing to film and edit. So we made that first one, American Monster Tour Oklahoma Demon Flyer, which is we investigate sightings of a pterosaur, a flying giant bird in Oklahoma, with some very credible witnesses. And we produced that ourselves on our own budget. And then we did some talking to networks with it, but we just put it on YouTube. We did film another one called Caddo Creature, which is almost done editing. We never really finished that. And the camera guy he went off on another show. He worked for like Ice Road Truckers or something.
And okay.
You know, he had to go out on the road. So we're almost done producing that, which will also just ultimately go on YouTube. But the shows are so expensive to produce, and they take so much time, that without some kind of outside funding or a network, you know, there's only a couple that we could do on our own dime. So those probably will just stand as an example of what we could do. And we're still contacted by various production companies saying, well, we'd like to do something like that, but that has yet to be all the way through the line to get produced.
Yeah, I love the concept, American Monster Tour, because I thought the documentary on YouTube was incredibly well made, really well narrated, and I was actually shocked, as much research as I do into the odd and weird, that you had photos of this giant pterodactyl looking like bird. That people had, I guess, one black and white photo where it was hung up on a side of a barn. And you said one of them, I think, was like 90 feet in length.
Well, there was a hoax photo. I mean, we talk about the various lore and legends of, you know, pterosaurs and people reporting seeing pterodactyls. Now there's that one on the barn, but that was a fabrication. For a while, it was circulating, like people were like, well, what is this? But finally, it was sorted out. But that doesn't erase the fact that there's been a lot of credible reports. And there is some photo, there was a photo taken in Papua New Guinea by a colleague of ours of a creature people call the ropin, which is described in a similar fashion to these relic flying dinosaurs. But yeah, it's an interesting subject, and certainly we just went and investigated a couple of hot witnesses in Oklahoma, but over the years, there's been many reports, and my colleague Ken Gerhard, yeah, man, that was kind of one thing he was really looking into for a while, and you wouldn't believe how many credible witnesses say they literally saw a flying pterodactyl, you know?
Now, speaking of flying monsters, that's kind of, I want to switch to another topic that you've done a lot of research on. Mothman, and I know there's the book that came out maybe last year or the year before about a lot of sightings that were seen around Chicago and Lake Michigan. Have you had an opportunity to research much of the Mothman mystery and some of the newer sightings that people have claimed?
Yeah, I mean, I'm familiar with the sightings in Chicago. My colleague Lon Strickler had put out a book on comprehensive book of some of the reports from that area. With Point Pleasant, West Virginia, the traditional Mothman that was first came to light back in 1966. There's a lot of potential witnesses, and you would think that obviously there was reports of this creature that people were seeing it, that you would have a way to corroborate these sightings because you don't have multiple witnesses. And in some cases there were, I haven't really, taken the time necessarily to delve into it to high detail, but I'm familiar enough to know that there are some credible sightings involved in that, and it just shows you that over the years, these Mothman-type entities, have been reported in many places throughout the U.S. We still don't know exactly what those creatures are, but they're certainly intriguing.
Yeah, it's certainly a mystery that warrants more investigation. I talked to the author who wrote a book called The Mothman of Lake Michigan, I think it might have been, was the title of the book. He actually went, he and his wife are investigators, and they went up and investigated all the sightings around Chicago. And I asked him, just point blank, how many of these could be explained away and how many couldn't. Over half of them could not be explained that he thought were actual literal sightings of, what we know as the Mothman. This was in from 2015 to 17. And it's amazing. I mean, one of the things that strikes me so interesting, and maybe it fascinates you too, is we find new species all the time, scientists do. But yet people, I guess, just kind of rain on the parade of folks who go out and look for things like Bigfoot or other types of cryptids, chupacabra, just anything and everything that might be mysterious or unexplainable, just kind of blow that off as superstition or whatever. But you yourself as an investigator, what percentage would you say of your investigations are turned out to be things that cannot be explained?
Well, I mean, certainly in anything, there's a certain number of them that you're going to find more ironclad than others. I mean, it's hard to say. It's just dependent on the witness, I mean, some people will swear that that's what they saw. And then, I could say, well, under the circumstances, there could be room for error. But I don't want to say for sure because I wasn't the one there. But in general, I would say that, a third of the sightings, I would say, are ones that I would put in the, okay, these are really, really good. And then, you know, 15% of those are like, okay, there's really something here. This is, you know, the more, you know, probability that these occurred. And really, ultimately, it doesn't matter if only one of those witnesses saw what they described seeing, then that's all it really takes to say that that creature exists, even if a bunch of other people, you know, say they saw a Bigfoot when they just really wishful thinking. But, you know, I think in any case, you just got to really categorize each sighting as, you know, this has possible hoax or mistaken identity, or, you know, was this pure daylight? What's the witness credibility? You know, once you rule all those things down, you got fallibility with, you know, people remembering exactly what they saw. So, but even if 10% of these things that are reported are of the actual cryptid, that's enough to, you know, continue to warrant the investigation.
Now, you got into the, like you said early on, into the Falk Monster, which people know as Boggy Creek. Actually, that was one of the, I remember seeing that movie when I was young, too, kind of, not at a drive-in, but I'm aging myself and dating myself here, but when VHS players, VCRs first came out, and everybody had a choice between VHS and Beta, you know, that was one of the videos that I first saw. When you go up into that part of Arkansas and you do your investigation, how receptive are the people there? I know they have a big festival there and there's so many people that love the genre, but the locals that live there, what kind of feedback have you gotten from them, like good and bad?
You know, it's mixed. And, you know, when I first went up there to start researching the case, you know, people were reluctant to talk to me. They, you know, nobody wants to be made fun of or the butt of a joke. You know, you have to be suspect on people's intentions if they're coming up there saying we're going to write a book or film a show. But as I continue to go up there and talk to people, I think they realized that I was sincere about this and I wasn't judging anybody. I'm just simply documenting the facts of the case. I'm not trying to say one way or another. I just want to, it's a cool story, so I want to get it all, the history of it. So that people can learn more about it, especially, you know, people that have seen the movie or have heard about it, or that are just into Bigfoot research or cryptid research. And over the years, of course, they became more receptive. Now, if I go there, of course, if anything happens, they're glad to tell me, you know, because they know it's in good hands. But you still always have that percentage of the people. Not their thing. They don't want, you know, people stomping through the woods looking for monsters, you know, whether it's in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, or whether it's in Falk, Arkansas, or anywhere else. You know, some people just are not going to like it. And that's understandable, you know, so, but I think today as it's gone, I mean, people are more receptive to this. And I think by all these television shows that have been on over the years that people realize, okay, it's not just me that saw something, or it's not just crazy people that say they've seen this, but there's just regular people that come across unexplainable things. So I think it's more acceptable to say you saw a creature now than say even 10 years ago when I was doing research, or 12 years ago or whatever, before a lot of these shows were running, people were a little more reluctant, but now it seems to be more popular and it's easier to get people to talk.
Now, when you've been out on your investigations, just say Bigfoot, for example, how close do you think you've come to actually, if Bigfoot is real, finding Bigfoot, like hearing tree knocks or legitimate type of evidence that you think you can kind of bring to that investigation?
There's been two occasions where I felt I could have possibly been close to a Bigfoot creature. One of those was in the Boggy Creek area, and that involved, was up with a colleague, and it was very late at night. We were canoeing along a bayou, and there was something howling And when we ended up getting out, pulling the canoe out of the water and going up this little hill where our tents were, whatever this thing was, presumably it followed us along that channel and began howling just right across the water, which is was probably 30 yards from where I was. And I grabbed a flashlight and basically ran down the hill through the trees trying to see if I could see whatever it was. And it just moved so quickly back into the woods and then howled again one more time and then just went quiet.
Okay, that's, so I
never saw it.
That's a little dangerous, don't you think, in the dark running toward a noise like that instead of from it?
I'm like, well, this might be my only chance, you know, and basically as long as I don't die, it will make a good story. So that's exactly what I did. I did that one other time in the Ocala National Forest in Florida, where I heard what sounded like something hitting on a tin can. I was there with a research friend of mine, Cindy Lee, and there was nobody out there. I mean, this was like in January. It was just the dead season. There was one other guy camping in the distance. But anyway, we heard this, and I grabbed the flashlight and kind of moved into the woods, and whatever was stopped the noise. And then I heard something get up and run. And so I kind of moved into the woods 15 or 20 yards, used the light. This thing stopped, and then as soon as I would start advancing, it got up and ran. And I could tell it wasn't a deer. You know, I've heard a lot of deer, and it wasn't something. It was something big. Not completely sure it wasn't a bear, but it didn't sound like a bear, just in the way its gait was. But again, I just kept pursuing, and it kept staying just one step ahead, and I never could get that light on it. And finally, I was like, I can't go any further. I'll be lost in here. Because I just sort of ran into there.
Yeah.
And there's been occasions where I found what looked to be a footprint, which I thought was intriguing. But I mean, ultimately, they don't provide, you know, the indisputable proof that we're looking for. So all those just sort of, you know, keep you fired up about doing it. But you know, as of yet, obviously, I don't have anything to say that these, you know, truly exist.
What's going to be unfortunate is it's probably going to take a body for anybody to believe that it's real, because you can find DNA evidence, you can get video and audio, and people are still going to claim it's a hoax. And unfortunately, that's my feeling on that until somebody presents a body, which you would hope would not be necessary, but very well might be.
Oh yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, at this point, that's all there is, because you could come up with the best looking footage and people are just going to say it's a hoax because of the technology we have. You know, and especially as far as people say, well, mainstream science won't take it seriously. Well, you know, these things, you know, Bigfoot has become a cultural icon. It's a pop culture figure, you know, some beef jerky commercials, and there's all these crazy TV shows. You know, at this point, science is going to require something a little bit more than someone just saying, oh, I saw one, or here's a footprint. And unfortunately, that's going to be a specimen. However it comes about, that's just the only way people are going to accept it.
I think probably the media is slow to realize this more than individual people are, because you know, just even recently on shows like 60 Minutes, you see more discussion, more serious discussion around the topic of UFOs, UAPs, people that are in the Air Force and Navy that are willing to come out and say, yeah, this is real. We've experienced this. But it seems like the other mysteries that are out there, which would, to me, seem more plausible, like cryptids, since we're discovering new species every day, that it's so weird that gets left on the back burner from media and... I think they unfortunately control the narrative, but when channels like Travel Channel and History Channel try to put those together and package them, and I know they do it for entertainment purposes, for the packaging, because it's about ratings. I think a lot of that gets, the real good research gets lost in the in the shuffle, so to speak. How many books do you have out at this point?
Six.
Okay, because I noticed quite a bit on Amazon where people can buy them. And now, is there another festival this year? Is it opening back up for the Falk Monster Festival?
Yes, June 19th. So, yeah, it's going to happen this year. It actually went ahead last year with a severely reduced capacity, but it seems like this year was a lot more of the festivals getting going. I just did the Ohio Bigfoot Conference, which was great. Obviously in Ohio, and then yeah, the Falk Festival is going to rock on June 19th in Falk.
Okay, yeah, because under the I guess one of the legends up there is the Ohio Grassman, which is another Bigfoot, a name for Bigfoot in that region. You have a list of all these different festivals that you've been through over the years. In normal times, how many festivals do you hit a year?
I'll probably do about a dozen appearances of sorts. Sometimes I'll do libraries. Libraries will invite me, even horror conventions, and then, Bigfoot conferences and Mothman Festival and other, there was a Lizard Man Festival once. I mean, all kinds of cryptid things. I probably do about a dozen, which are always crammed into spring and fall. Mostly that's when most of them happen. So sometimes, especially in the fall, it's like I am gone every weekend, nearly every weekend for 2 months. Just, that's like about 8 festivals. Boom, boom, boom.
Okay. Yeah. That's one of the questions I wanted to ask was, you mentioned you had a daughter, right? And I don't know how she is, but with all the investigations that you do, the books and the festivals, and your music, I mean, how many weeks a year are you on the road?
Well, last year I had considerable more time at home, but normally it's a lot. I mean, with the band, I cut down the touring. I mean, I spent, since I was about in my early 20s, I did a lot of touring and played in bands, so, and toured around the world. So I cut the band touring back quite a bit, but then, the investigations and research and the book stuff got me out, plus the festivals. Yeah, it's a lot of travel. Just has gone a lot back and forth, which is just a lot to do.
I even noticed on your Instagram, you were, I don't know how long ago it was, but you were on the East Coast out on a boat actually doing an investigation on a sighting for a sea creature that was spotted off. It just boggles my mind how many different creatures are out there that you're different types of investigations. So it's not just one thing you focus on, like cryptids like Bigfoot or something like that. It's so many different. How did that go?
Well, that was something that anytime I go anywhere, I either am knowledgeable on what has been reported in the area, or I will look it up and try to find out. I just happened to be going to Pensacola on a little vacation thing with my girlfriend, and I took the opportunity to do two sorts of research. I was doing research on another book project that has to do with that town, and then also there had been a famous sighting, there's a famous story from 1962 about the Pensacola sea serpent. And that's when supposedly some people were killed by this sort of Loch Ness type thing there in the bay. So I tried to locate where that occurred and went out to, at least to kind of look at the area, well knowing that I'm not going to necessarily see a sea serpent, of course, but it's just cool to go to those places and say, okay, this is where this story came from. You can read a lot of this stuff on the internet, but it's a different thing to go there. And a lot of times when you start talking about these kind of things with the locals, you'll find out stuff that you never knew or wasn't even, publicized. Oh yeah. Somebody will tell you that their cousin saw something or whatever. And that kind of proactive travel and research always leads to great stories. A lot of my stuff just comes from going out and just, beating the bushes or the waves, as so to speak.
Yeah.
And finding stuff out. So that was kind of part, just a fun trip, but also, you know, obviously, you know, gotta inform my girlfriend that there was a sea serpent or whatever, and we're gonna check this out, and we have a good time with it.
Well, that's pretty cool. Yeah, I've never really been in any of these types of investigations. The one thing I did try to investigate, and I actually wrote about it, was the Georgia Guidestones, and it's very different when you actually get to a location, standing there at that location, and then trying to talk to the locals about it, and being standoffish and not wanting to talk, and those that do want to be off the record, and it's kind of hard to balance that. So I can just imagine when you go into these investigations, if I had that experience with just one thing, I can just imagine times 10 when you go into these investigations, kind of the pushback and the feedback you're getting really has to be a drag on the investigation itself. But like you said, the living history, just to stand there in a place, is really cool. I did want to ask you, and I want to get into your band a little bit too, but I wanted to ask you, of all the places that you've been investigating cryptids, whether it be Mothman, Bigfoot type creatures, is there a region where the sightings seem to be more credible, where there's more of a likelihood that we're going to discover that evidence of a Bigfoot or a Bigfoot type creature?
In general, there's no one area I think that's more quote unquote credible, but certainly when you start looking at a place where people are reporting a certain kind of creature, say a Bigfoot, for example, if that is in an area where there is a lot of forestry, there's, you know, vast swamplands, or there's mountainous regions, that tends to sort of support the idea that a small population of these things could actually survive and remain hidden. Whereas if I'm in West Texas, you know, and somebody tells me they saw a Bigfoot, well, I'm looking for miles and I don't see any trees, you know.
Nothing to hide in, yeah.
It's not that they didn't see something, but, you know, that's when it's really just dependent on the location and the region. And so, of course, when I'm in an area, you know, in southeast Oklahoma and in western Arkansas, there's the Ouachita Mountains. There's some really credible Bigfoot sightings that have come out of there. So when I go up there to that area and go deep into those woods, as I've done, you just really realize, dude, there could be anything out here living, and I'd never see it if it didn't want me to see it. And that gives you the perspective that then if I hear somebody, a hunter up there, tell me he saw a Bigfoot, then, you know, my interest is piqued because I'm thinking, yeah, this is a place you're going to find one for sure.
Yeah, and if, you know, if people think the Appalachian Trail is a long trail, over 2,000 miles, just imagine the empty, well, not empty, but just like vast land that people haven't explored off that trail. You know, it's just anything. Right. I mean, people, fugitives go up there if they want to go missing and not be found, you know.
Perfect example. And I mean, I've interviewed first person witnesses that have had sightings along the Appalachian Trail of Bigfoot. So, yeah, I mean, that's a place right there where, you know, a lot of forestry, anything could be up there.
Now, I do have quite a few listeners in the Arizona, New Mexico area, and I think one of the things that I was asked when I mentioned that you were coming on the show was, have you had any experience with research out in like the superstitions or researching skinwalkers, the possibility of skinwalkers?
Well, as a matter of fact, I've been up to the Taos area with Red River, New Mexico, up in the Carson National Forest, the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, on occasions. My family liked to vacation out there, so I took some time to study some Bigfoot research having to do with New Mexico, and I even interviewed some witnesses in that area once. You know, obviously there is some reports along the in that area, and even in Arizona, of a Bigfoot-like creature. There's a history of that which, you know, I'm familiar with. And then, of course, when you're talking about New Mexico and those areas, you're going to come across that kind of skinwalker legends and lore. And, you know, I've never really delved too much into that research. I'm familiar with it. And, you know, I've read the Hunt for the Skinwalker book, which is a very compelling book about the ranch. But I've never, you know, had access to any or anything to it. It, you know, it's been a private property and very few people have actually been on it over the years. But I'm familiar with that. And I think it's very intriguing. And, I mean, you know, maybe one day even write a book on it or something.
I think one thing that gets lost on, you know, I guess just casual fans that watch those shows. The things that gets lost on folks is that there's such a long history, hundreds of years of history, actually, of those legends going back through Native American word of mouth and storytelling and drawings and carvings for Bigfoot, for Skinwalker, you know, for so many different mysteries that we investigate and have shows about today. These are stories that they were telling 200, 300, 400, 500 years ago. And before we even became a country.
Yeah, and it almost, I mean, it underscores the fascination that we, you know, as humans have with the unknown and the possibility of unknown creatures or people, or in the case of Skinwalker, the perhaps people's abilities to transform into other creatures or beings. And yeah, that every bit of this goes back to Native American, especially with skinwalkers, where, you know, those stories originated from, you know, from the tribes that lived out there. And it's kind of like a Native American version of werewolves to me. It's sort of associated with that. And the question is, you know, when you start going into that, are we talking about people that really transform, or do they transform just within their own mind? You know, what is that all about? And is that a supernatural, you know, type thing? Or just what is it? There's so much about the mystery of skinwalkers that we don't really understand or can't explain. But there are tales even in modern times of people seeing what they would describe as a skinwalker.
Yeah, shapeshifters are in front of you. And some people even describe them as shapeshifters all the way to demonic. And you know, somewhere in there might be some truth. And hopefully at some point we'll get more clarity on that as more people like yourself investigate these things. Now, your rock band, Ghoultown, you have 9 albums out. Tell us a little bit about the band.
Ghoultown is a band I started in 1999. It's hard to explain the sound. I describe it as sort of a middle ground between Johnny Cash and Rob Zombie. We embrace sort of a dark Western motif, I guess, and it's got a little bit of psychobilly, rock, cowpunk, and even spaghetti Western overtones. And you know, I played in metal bands and punk bands prior to that, and I really wanted to start something that was really unique and my own thing. So with that, and we even and following, so I've tried to keep the band going, even though I've kind of, like I said, cut back on actual touring and stuff. But there's plenty of fans, and we just did an album last year, so I try to keep that in, you know, because it's all fun to do, and it kind of gives me a break. You know, I'm writing and researching, then I can go play some gigs or do an album, and kind of back and forth. It kind of keeps me fresh and fired up about everything I do.
Now, people can check your band out on YouTube as well, right? You have where can they buy your CDs at, your music?
Yeah, Ghoultown can be found just wherever finer music is sold. You know, you can stream it on YouTube. You can download from iTunes and Amazon and Bandcamp and everywhere. CDs on various sites, and you can go to ghoultown.com and order CDs and vinyl from there as well.
So you had a really cool story. I noticed that on your bio on the website, you had the station Shudder, the channel Shudder listed, which is a horror channel, which is right up my alley with horror films. You guys have a pretty cool story how you wrote a song for an icon, Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. Tell us that story and how that happened. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that was one of the high points. I mean, I'm a huge horror fan and, you know, love all the genre. The Shudder thing came when I was on Joe Bob Briggs' Last Drive-In, which is a streaming series on Shudder. Joe Bob Briggs has been a sort of horror host for many years, and I was a guest on his first marathon. The Elvira, Mistress of the Dark thing was back in around 2009 or 2010. We were playing, Ghoultown was playing at a VIP party at a horror convention in which Elvira was a guest, and her manager saw us play and thought we were cool and I guess hyped us up to Elvira, Cassandra, and she wanted to meet us. So I met with her the next day. We just got to talking, you know, of course I'm a fan, and she just kind of suggested, you guys should write a song. Maybe we could do something together. And that's exactly what we did. I came and I wrote a song and submitted it to them. They loved it. We recorded it, and then we flew out to Hollywood and filmed a video, kind of an extended length video there in Hollywood featuring her and the band. And so that obviously has been one of the coolest things I've done, and was certainly got us a lot of exposure by exposing us to her fans, you know, and it was, you know, just super fun. She's just an awesome person.
That is pretty cool, because it actually aired on what her show's called, Movie Macabre. Is it?
Yeah, she, you know, she's had shows off and on, and when she was doing her Movie Macabre show, I don't know, airing whenever that was. It's been some years, but you know, they played the video on that show even. So
that's pretty awesome. You have some events coming up. Speaking of New Mexico, June 10th, the Red River Community House. What's going on there?
Yeah, I just happened to be going out there to do a little vacationing and driving through that area. So I just thought, well, what the heck, man? I love that little town. So I set up an engagement where I'm going to do an hour-long presentation on the history of Southern Bigfoot, and particularly the history of Bigfoot in New Mexico and the area around there. So it's free. People can just come on down, and I guess if there's enough room in that community center, I don't remember how big it is, but come on down.
Yeah, hopefully, you know, as things open up, these things. How full is your schedule the rest of the year? Are you getting back to normal with the festivals this year, and are any tour dates with the band coming up?
Yeah, fall is really packed. You know, I'm doing the Mothman Festival, Honeybee Bigfoot Conference, Texas Bigfoot Conference. Can't remember what all goes on there. Some libraries.
Is Bishopville, South Carolina, on the agenda this year for the Lizard Man Festival?
No, they were doing a festival, and I was at the first one, and then it's kind of wavered back and forth. They tried to do it. The problem there is Bishopville, as the city committee or whomever, they really haven't been totally behind doing the festival. You know, I guess they didn't get the memo that 12,000 people show up in Point Pleasant to the Mothman Festival each year and bring in tons of money to that little town. Not that the Lizard Man is going to be bigger than Mothman, but, you know, hey, you've got the thing, go with it. But unfortunately, there's no Lizard Man Festival this year.
Yeah, a friend of mine actually a couple of years ago went to it. He came up out of Savannah and just went to that. He said everybody there was just having such a good time. He was shocked to see such a small town so crowded. But he had a good time. He loved it. Hopefully they'll get back to it. There is one more mystery I wanted to kind of bring up with you, because I noticed it was a project you were working on. Pertaining to the mystery of the Rougarou, which is the Cajun werewolf. What's the project you're working on that's regarding that?
I will be narrating that documentary film. I've narrated, I think to date, 7 films. They're by the Small Town Monsters film company out of Ohio with director Seth Breedlove, and I got involved way back on their third film when they covered the Boggy Creek Monster. So the new film coming up is going to be Howl of the Rougarou, and we're going to be delving into the legends of, you know, the Rougarou, which is a werewolf type, dogman type creature in Louisiana. It's very much a Cajun, you know, the Cajuns tell of this tale. So, you know, there's always interviews with witnesses and then telling the history and what effects this has had on, you know, local culture and communities. And I'll be narrating that. So if anybody wants to see any of the Small Town Monsters films, you can just, those are the best place to look is Amazon streaming. So if you got Amazon Prime, you can just, you know, just type Lyle Blackburn in there and they'll all come up. We've done two movies on Mothman, Bray Road Beast, Boggy Creek Monster, Terror in the Skies, a lot of really cool, well-made, thoughtful documentaries on cryptid subjects.
Have you done any investigation through Honey Island down near New Orleans?
Yeah. I've been down there a couple of times, and I wrote extensively about it in a couple of books. In one of my recent books, Sinister Swamps, I have a whole chapter dedicated to the Honey Island Swamp, you know, mystery. And I've interviewed some, in fact, I've got witnesses in there that their stories have never been told before. So I've got a really good, you know, written about my investigations and my in interviews into, you know, that creature.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. You do a lot of fascinating work. I certainly appreciate you coming on and doing the podcast. Real quick before we go, did you want to tell people where they can find you online, where they can follow you and hopefully meet up with you on the road at one of these festivals?
Yeah, certainly. You know, just come by LyleBlackburn.com, and that's got links to, you know, the various books and movies and the band, and, you can jump off from there as you will. All my books are available on Amazon.com. In, you know, paperback, some in hardback, and in ebook format, so you can check those out there. And if you want the hot sauce, you know, I guess best I can say is just get in line or show up at one of my events, because certainly I'll have some there. That's the easiest way. And you know, my list of events there is on my LyleBlackburn.com page, and, you know, definitely come out and support these events. They seem to be doing it the safe way, and just enjoy them because they're really fun.
Yeah, that's as the world opens back up, I think we all need to jump headfirst back in it. So, yeah, good luck with all that on the road. You may even bump into me at one of these. I noticed there's one coming up in Frankfort, Kentucky. There's something in Frankfort, I think, that comes up, Frankfort, Kentucky.
That might be, is it CryptidCon?
Yeah, CryptidCon. Actually, my office is located in Frankfort, so I may have to look and see when CryptidCon is there and then make sure I'm in town. So,
I did that one several years ago. It's a good one.
Yeah, so, folks, definitely check out his books, get some hot sauce, and if you ever sell replicas of that sweet hat you're wearing, with the skull and the crossbones there. Before the show, I was telling him that it reminded me of that hat that Jim Morrison from The Doors used to wear on stage, sort of, in a way. But it's one of the most cool, unique hats. If I saw somebody walking through a crowd with that hat, I'd be like, I'll be damned, that's Lyle Blackburn. Even if I didn't see your face, like, I'll be damned, that's him. But
It helps with the recognition. And almost now, you know, at this point, I just wear the hat, because if I don't, people go, where's the hat? So even with the association with the bands, that's where I first was wearing it. And then this, I just wear it. People say, where did you, I actually got it in Mexico a number of years ago. People always ask me, where can I get a hat like that? I'm like, I don't know, because I've never seen one precisely like it. I'm trying to find a backup, but, you know, I got this in Mexico back in, I think, 98 or so. And, it's my prized possession.
That's pretty cool. Pretty cool hat. So from writing to music to film, you're covering all the bases. Lyle Blackburn, thanks for being on the Gonzo Chronicles. I certainly appreciate it. You're welcome back anytime. And folks, go buy some hot sauce, go buy some books. And we'll see you on down the road.